Actually, I'd like to read this. Here's a book from Oxford called Indian Philosophy, a very short introduction. And there's a little section on Shankara's non-dualism. So I'd like to read that. I'm going to be giving a lecture on this at the university on Monday, if the world still exists. And so I thought I could read this. I got to fall asleep in the class. Thought I could read this and then make some comments. So we're talking about the Mimamsa group. I'll do something. Other Orthodox thinkers, Orthodox means they accepted the Vedas as authority. Following the approach of Bhadarayana, author of the Vedanta Sutras, Brahma Sutras, and drawing on his summary of the Upanishads and the Brahma Sutra, saw the injunctions of the Vedas in the context of the need to acquire knowledge of the essence of the cosmos. Because the Mimamsa group, of course, they said that the essence of the Vedas is the injunction to perform sacrifice, which is what they did for a living, and try to go to heaven, material heaven, swarga kama yajeta. So other people said, no, the essence, the injunctions of the Vedas really meant to bring us knowledge. Acquire knowledge of the essence of the cosmos, Brahman, rather than the performing of sacrificial rituals. There is evidence of a long lineage of so-called Vedantin thinkers. The Upanishads are the Vedanta, or the end of the Veda, because there were the original Vedic Sanghitas like Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, and so on. And then the Brahmana literature, the Aranyaka literature, and the Upanishads. So that's the end of the Vedas. So the Upanishads are also called Vedanta, and the Brahma Sutra was an attempt to systematize and explain the Upanishads. And of course the Bhagavad Gita is also accepted as authority. So Vedanta really technically means what's called Prasthana Acharya, this three literally departures, or three points of departure. The Upanishads, which are the Shruti Prasthana, the Upanishads are Shruti, and then the Vedanta Sutras, the Brahma Sutras, which are the Nyaya, logic, the reasoning, and the Bhagavad Gita, which is Smriti, but the Word of God. So, it was the highly influential Shankara, who lived during the 8th century CE, that means the 700s, who consolidated Vedanta through consolidated Vedanta thought systematically enough to engage in serious polemical debate with others. Shankara's principal work was a commentary on Bhadarayana's Brahma Sutra, explicating what he saw as a definitive exegesis, interpretation of scriptures, of the message of the Upanishads. His main non-commentarial work, in other words, the Brahma Sutra is a commentary on an existing work. Then he had an original work, which is not a commentary, the Upadesha Sahasri, the Thousand Teachings. Shankara used the Brahma Sutra, the Upanishads themselves, and the Bhagavad Gita as his three basic texts, and his exegetical work sought to present their teaching as a unity, what is called the triple foundation of revealed truth, Prasanna Traya. So that's very good for us. Is it light on in that room there? Mm-hmm. Other side.
There he is.
Yeah. Because it's nice that Shankar accepts the Bhagavad Gita because the Bhagavad Gita basically refutes most of what he taught. So that gives us a tremendous advantage in discussing this issue. To grasp Shankara's position of Advaita Vedanta, a non-dual interpretation of the ontology, ontology means philosophy of existence, of the ontology principally expressed in the Upanishad, one might take his starting point as the passage from the Chandogya Upanishad, which states, in the beginning this world was just being, i.e., Brahman, one only without a second, and it thought to itself, let me become many, let me multiply myself. That's the Chandogya Upanishad. The only problem with that is that i.e. Brahman is not in the Upanishads. As we look at the book, I'll read you what the Sanskrit is. The Upanishad, I'll show you how. Let's see. That thing I just read is from Chandogya Upanishad 6:2-3. So I think I have it marked here. Sanskrit is as follows. Sadeva somya idamagra asirekamad evaditiyam. So, Agre, in the beginning, Sadeva, this existence alone, existed. It was one without a second. And then, the other relevant part, and it thought to itself, Tadaikshita Bhamsyam. Aikshita can mean thought to itself, or it also can mean simply glance, like the Lord glanced over Prakriti. Bahusyam, I should be many. Bahusyam, prajayayeti, and I should, let me procreate, or I should procreate. So that's the end of the creation. So there's a few things about this. Hare Krishna, make yourself comfortable. Let's see your chin. First of all, it says here in the translation, in the beginning, this world was just being, i.e. Brahman. But i.e. Brahman, of course, not in Sanskrit. And the idea that, of course, the idea that all this world is Brahman is in the Upanishads. But here, it's not specifically talking about Brahman as such. And then here's another quote. So you take that quote, that in the beginning there was only Brahman, or only, actually, existence. It doesn't say Brahman. And then another quote from the Chandogya Upanishad, by means of just one lump of clay, everything made of clay can be known. Any modifications are merely distinctions, names. The reality is just clay. So the example here is, I'm sure you've heard this before, that if you take a little, in Sanskrit, mritpinda, just a little ball of clay, you take some clay and then make other clay objects like electric toothbrushes and battery-operated lawnmowers. Then, if you make like pots or different things out of clay, then it's all really just clay. And so that's basically Shankara's argument, that because the Upanishads say that Brahman is everything, Brahman is the world, Sarvam Kalvidam Brahma, and since Brahman doesn't have parts, therefore we can't be parts. We must just all be Brahman. The problem with that, many problems with that. For one thing, the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that we're all part of him. And Shankara accepts the Bhagavad Gita. And Krishna says, Mamai Vamsha. So, plus, let me see, this is a good practice. Maybe let me just go back to that verse in the Upanishad, the clay thing, where if you take clay, whatever you make out of it is still just clay. So here's the Sanskrit. 6:1-4. Yatha somya ekena mritpindena sarvam rinmayam vigyatam syat vacharambanam vikaro namadeyam mritiketeva satyam. So, which is by means of just one lump of clay, everything made of clay can be known. Any modifications, and the word there is vikara, transformation, are merely verbal distinction, names. The reality is just clay. And then Shankara says about this, in his commentary, Shankara says, Vaga lambana matram namaiva kivalam navikaro nama bastuatsi paramartato mitaketyeva mitikaiva tu satyam bastuasti. Which means that basically the name itself, or the name alone, like you say, like the name there meaning like a pot or a spoon or something made out of clay. It's merely resorting to language, vaga lambana mata. It's merely, the name itself is it's merely resorting to language. It depends upon language, and the vikara, the transformation, which is just a name, like you call it, like you take clay and you make it into a pot and you give it the name pot. And so he says it's not that's not the substance. That's not the actual substance. That's just a name. And in the highest sense, it's simply clay. And it's clay alone, which is the truth here, in other words, which is actually the substance. So whatever you make out of clay, it's still just clay. Mm-hmm. So a few things about that. Number one, the Sanskrit word that the Upanishad uses for the, what's translated, this is Chandogya Upanishad, a modification of clay, like making a pot or something else, is vikara. And Krishna specifically says in the Bhagavad Gita, in chapter 13, that it is only the physical nature, prakriti, which is subject to these transformations, and souls are not subject to those transformations. And Shankara's whole argument is that if you think you're an individual soul, think again. Because the fact that you're just an individual soul, now that's just a vikara. That's just a transformation of Brahman, but actually those are names only. Those aren't, that's not a substantial change. But Krishna explicitly says in the Gita that the individual soul is not a transformation. That's really just what it is. It's a soul. Soul is a soul. It's not a transformation. So again, the Bhagavad Gita basically teaches exactly the opposite of what Shankara teaches, and Shankara says that the Gita is authoritative. And the Gita very nicely refutes almost everything he taught. So, which is amazing how he could possibly think that the Bhagavad Gita would support his philosophy. It actually astonishes me. Another point is that even though you could say that, let's say you make a clay pot, which all of us do, right? On a daily basis, we all make clay pots. So, let's say if you make a clay pot, even though the substance is still clay, but a pot is a pot. When you need a, hey, Veronica, come on. Still a few good seats. Here's some seats here if you want. These cost a little more because they're up close. Come on, you may want to jump into the dialogue.
I'm just waiting for my friend.
Okay. So, now, when you make a pot out of clay, or if you make, let's say, what else do people make out of clay? A plate. Cup. I mean, a plate isn't, I mean, you don't want to pour a bunch of lemonade on a plate, because a plate is not a pot, which probably none of you ever really understood that before, but that's my job as a guru. Yeah, to explain to you that actually a plate is not a pot. I mean, none of you probably could have realized on your own without the help of a bona fide spiritual master. So, the idea is that when we make different things out of clay, hey, how you doing? Are you Veronica's friend?
Yeah.
Come on in, have a seat. We're just discussing philosophy. It's relatively painless. So, I mean, there is a sense, we're discussing a philosopher named Shankara, who lived in the 700s in India, and was teaching what we call impersonalism, that God is not ultimately a person, and individual souls are not really ultimately individual. That's an illusion. You eventually merge into some big cognizant, radiant blob. So, and we're refuting that. We're in the process of, we're the good guys in that philosophy, that they're the bad guys. So, if you think about it, what are you going to do just with a big hunk of clay? The example is if you take a bunch of clay and make pots out of it or plates out of it, or just, you know, make whatever, build a house out of clay. Whatever you build out of it, it's still just clay. So you can give different names to it, like cottage, pot, dish, or whatever. You can give different names to it, but it's really just clay. Yeah, but it's also really a house. And it's also really a dish. And it's also really a cup or a pot. And even though the substance is the same, it's actually the nature of the world that the same substance can, in fact, be made into many things. In fact, almost everything on the planet now is made of plastic. So there's an example of a naturally occurring, easily biodegradable within a trillion years substance, like, say, plastic, which can is made into innumerable things, almost all of which are at the present time produced in China. So, does anyone make anything in plastic in any other country in the world? So, but the idea is that's the nature of the world. Even though things have the same substance, in fact, the same substance can be and is molded or transformed into various objects. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing. For example, we could say that all of us, our bodies are made of the same substances, same basic chemicals or physical elements, and yet the fact that we're all individual and everybody gets their own body is really a nice thing. Because, I don't know if you've ever tried, like, sharing a body with someone else or, like, haunting someone else's body or having yours haunted by someone else. You can get old after a while. So, it's really a great thing. It's really a great thing that we're individual. We have freedom. I mean, if you're not free, nowadays in the world people value freedom so much, and it's a great thing to be a person. It means you have your own little kooky consciousness, and we have our freedom, and you have your own life. You can enter into or exit relationships. It means that you're a free person. You can choose to put salt and pepper or not on your food. I love getting to be an individual free person. I think it's a great idea. And I wouldn't want to do it any other way. In fact, that is the Beta philosophy. That is the philosophy taught by Lord Chaitanya, by many other people actually, including the Jewish philosopher. At the time of Jesus, there was a prominent philosopher in Alexandria, Egypt, named Philo, who taught Beta. Plotinus, actually the Roman philosopher, not born in Rome, but... All right.
You have to take this?
No, I just turned the ringer off. So, I better turn my ring, since this call, okay. I'm going to turn my ringer off. You can all turn your ringers off. So, Beta, one and different means that things, for example, God. God is pure spirit, and we are also pure spirit. The difference is that he's a lot more pure spirit than we are. So Krishna is infinite, and we are, you know, pretty small. We forget that sometimes, but do the math. We're actually really tiny. So the idea is that it seems obvious that what the case is, that you can have different real things made out of the same substance. So that, for example, let's say you have a car and your neighbor has a car, and then you drive away in your neighbor's car saying that, well, you know, your car, that's just a name. It's all the same substance, made out of the same stuff. So therefore, I just drove your car. Because after all, to say it's your car is just, it's just words. No, they're really two different objects. Your car and your neighbor's car are really different cars. And the fact that they're made out of the same substance, okay, but they're still different cars. And when you need a car, or when you need a toothpick, or whatever you need, you know, you need that thing. And if you got one, I mean, there could be a trillion toothpicks in the world, but that won't help you if you've got something stuck between your teeth. So there's a very gritty, earthy example. So Shankar's argument that things that are made out of the same substance are really just the same thing, yes, but they're also different things. They're also different objects. And so, because Shankar is so famous in India, I'm trying to figure out the force of his arguments, and it's kind of escaping me. Like, why is this stuff being taken so seriously?
Why is what?
Shankar's philosophy.
Why is his being taken so seriously?
His philosophy. Mm-hmm. Why is that philosophy being taken so seriously when it's just obviously not true?
He promotes hedonism.
Hedonism. Well, it does kind of knock God out of the box. So you don't have to worry about annoying things like someone above you making rules, which can be very annoying. And so if you say that it's all one, then you don't have to worry about that. And you can proceed as you like. So this is the book which I'm using in my course. It's a book from Oxford University Press on Indian philosophy. So we're just reading this, and I'm actually using you all. I'm shamelessly using you. So I have to give a lecture on this on Monday. So I go through it first. But it is interesting. It is interesting. These key passages establish for Shankara two fundamental points. A non-dual monistic universe. There's only one thing in the universe, which is Brahman, the Absolute. The substance of which is Brahman, and the fact that all change is only apparent. Brahman does not actually change. In other words, even though we look out and see a world in which there's trees and houses and harmonicas and used trucks and so on, and people, it's really only one thing. So the variety we see, the fact there's different colors, textures, shapes, different objects, up and down and sideways, that's all an illusion, ultimately. I mean, it's real, but it's not the highest reality. The real fact is, and this is, again, I'm trying to explain this, and the trouble explaining is because it just seems so ridiculous. The idea is that, let me start from something which I think is true, and it's obviously true. And that is, let's say you buy a car, and the Consumer Report says that car will probably last around 37 minutes after you drive it off the lot. It's like a really bad car. And there's another car that will last 10 years without problems. And so your friends may say, don't get that car. That car's useless. Buy this other car. That's a real car. And so, if there are things that are eternal, if there are friendships, romances, houses, pleasures in general, states of awareness which are eternal, then obviously that's infinitely more valuable than things which aren't, which are temporary, which is self-destruct, or something else destroys them. I mean, if you fall in love, obviously, falling in love with someone where the relationship will last, assuming that you continue to love this person by systematically filtering out many different aspects of their personality. But let's say, for example, you fall in love with someone. Let's say you fall in love with someone and you really love that person. And so, then obviously, for the relationship to last is better than just blowing up at a certain point. And living is much better than dying. So things that are permanent, eternal, if they're good, desirable things, are infinitely more valuable than things which end, which perish. So in that sense, you could say a house in this world is not a real house in the sense that it's a bunch of material energy formed into a house. And it didn't exist before, it won't exist in the future, now it exists. In the context of eternity, Even say a house lasts 100 years, that's like almost nothing. And so if you could find a beautiful house that you could live in forever, that's much more valuable. It's infinitely more valuable. And so that makes sense. But to say that, okay, as long as you are not enlightened, you see houses and bodies walking around, and they're really there, but when you become enlightened, they're not really there. Like, what does that mean? And this is what, I mean, this is what Shankara is teaching, or the impersonalist, that, like, for example, let me go on reading, and it's, if it doesn't make sense to you, congratulations, because I don't think it makes sense. If it makes sense to you, I think you have a problem. So, anyway, Shankara goes to some lengths, however, to establish that the appearance of plurality, that means there's lots of things, like all of us, this is a plurality of people right here. This is a plurality of words on the page, there's more than one. So Shankara goes to some lengths, however, to establish that the appearance of plurality does have, sitiyane, conventional reality. Conventional reality. Bless you.
Thank you.
Don't let it happen again. Even if it is not ultimately real. Okay, we can agree with that. Sure. This book is not ultimately real in the sense that if you wait long enough, it'll disintegrate and it won't be a book anymore. So it's not ultimately a book. You know, when there's no more time, the scoreboard clock, it's not a book. So Shankara introduces two levels of reality, conventional and absolute. These are translations, of course, of Sanskrit words. Now the Buddhists do that. The Buddhists do that because the Buddhists had a real problem. Namely that they believed, many of them, not all of them, actually some of them believed, that Buddha was teaching there's no soul. Although, interestingly, Buddha didn't actually say that. But they feel he was sort of hinting at it, or strongly hinting at it, or whatever. So, but the Buddha, in his teachings, at least what they believe are his teachings, because there's all these historiographical issues, but the Buddha, in his teachings, keeps doing things like using personal pronouns, like I and you, and we and those guys over there. In fact, when the Buddha was enlightened, his enlightenment consisted of three stages. Isn't it? What are the three things he realized in his enlightenment? Number one, all his past lives. And number two, he realized how all souls, well, not all souls, how karma was going on for everybody. And number three was, I guess, nirvana, that there's a way out of this mess. What's interesting is, that Buddha's first realization, according to these somewhat problematic historical sources, is that he had many past lives. He had many past lives. But if there's no soul, what do you mean he had past lives? Like, who are we talking about there? Because if there's no self, if there's no soul, who was it that had all the past lives? But Buddha did talk like that. Like, yeah, I was this and I was that. And I, you know, I once worked at the sold Gatorade down at the corner. So Buddha had all these, he had all these past lives, but there's no person. So who had all the past lives? But he talked like that. I did. I had past lives. Then I did this, and I did that. Then I did the other thing. So, and also Buddha, that was the embarrassing thing. He never actually explicitly, flat out said there's no soul, and a lot of times he talked as if there was a soul, although he didn't say there was a soul. And there were lots of Buddhists, actually, back then, that believed there was a soul, and that believed that Buddha was teaching it. You don't hear about that now, for various reasons, but it's a fact. There was a group called the Pudgalavadins, who Pudgala means Purusha, the person. And they believed and taught, and were a very significant group in India, that they were Buddhists, that there is a soul. Mahayana group is now 85% of Buddhism. but I mean, 85% of all the Buddhists in the world or more belong to this group, which believes that ultimately everyone has within them the Buddha Dhatu, the Buddhist nature. So a bodhisattva is a person that, well, not a person, but someone remarkably resembling a person who makes the decision that rather than go up into that great big nirvana up in the sky, I'm going to come back to this world and I'm going to help poor, you know, all the poor, dumb people down here. So, the unenlightened people. So that's the bodhisattva. And he's very merciful, or she or it is very merciful. And they actually choose perpetually. They choose perpetually to remain what looks exactly like an individual person and help other people out of compassion and to help others who look very much like people. And that everyone actually has within them this Buddhist nature. In other words, you inside, you're a bodhisattva just waiting to happen. And it just has to be revived. It's inside of you. You've got this enlightened nature. In fact, you've got enlightenment within you. You just have to be enlightened. And then once you're enlightened, then you can come back and help other people. So this is very personal stuff. So more important than impersonal nirvana is compassion, caring about people, being nice to people. These are all very personal qualities. And you, as an individual, whatever you are, help other individual, whatever they are. So, similarly, Shankara. That was the point. So the Buddhists, and many of them were teaching there's no self, there's no soul. They were really. It amazes me that people could be so enthusiastic about philosophically annihilating themselves. Like, I don't know, like, maybe your mother didn't hug you when you were a baby or something. I really don't get it. It's like, the last thing in the world I would want to do is philosophically annihilate myself. It's like, why would I want to do that? I'm having too much fun. So, and to be so, like, hell-bent on this, that you write books and give arguments and no, you know, we're not eternal persons and we're against eternal persons. Like, it actually amazes me that people would dedicate their lives to philosophically annihilating themselves. I find it just astonishing. But they have this problem. The Buddha never explicitly denied the self, and he, or the soul, and he, a lot of times he kept talking as if we were persons. In fact, for example, there's one quote, which the Pudgala, you know, like the person philosophers in Buddhism would teach, which was an embarrassment for the non-self group. Now, as Buddha said that this material body and all of our material emotions and material consciousness, it's a burden, and the person carries the burden. So it's like, wait a second, there is no person. Like, who's the person carrying this burden? Because the whole point was, on the impersonal side of Buddhism, and there very much was a personal side of Buddhism, Buddhism is very actually the side that won, to be honest. So, on the impersonal side of Buddhism, we have what are called, and I get back to Shankara, you have what are called five skandhas. It means aggregate, which was just sort of Buddhist appropriation of something that's already there in the Vedas, the Upanishads, the five koshas. Or not five, but koshas. It means coverings. Like we have the body, the physical body. We have our material emotions. We have the way we kind of classify the world. We have our, you could say, deep psychological conditioning. From our past karma, we have all these deep propensities and inclinations, phobias, which are not really irrational fears, they're just sort of left over from scary past life experiences. Like if someone is afraid of a certain situation, and people think that's just an irrational fear or phobia, it's actually because in your past life, something really scary happened to you, and that stuff still frightens you. So, that's called sankskara. That's the term used in the Yoga Sutras, and also used in Buddhism, actually. And then finally, vijnana, which is kind of like when you put it all together, your conditioned consciousness. So Buddha, when he became enlightened, he traveled, and when he met some of his old meditation buddies, when he was still on the way to becoming the Buddha, he still wasn't the Buddha yet, and he had some meditation buddies, you know, they were doing like these terrible austerities and meditating. And then he went off by himself and became enlightened, and then he came back and his buddy said, "Hey, Buddha." I didn't say Buddha. He said, "Hey, Gotam, you know, man, what's happening?" And he said, and then the Buddha said, "This is the way it's depicted." I don't think the real Buddha was that pompous and stiff. But the Buddha is you know, on record as saying, "Do not address me in that way. You do not know who I am. I am now the Father. Do not insult the Father. Do not call me by my name." Like a really nice guy. But anyway, it's interesting, like, when you have, like, young, neophyte, fanatical followers, which, of course, we never had in the Hare Krishna movement, that they can sometimes be, like, overly formal, like they say, you know, more Catholic than the Pope. And so, anyway, so Buddha gave his sermon. He gave the sermon in the Deer Park, converted his old meditation buddies. Then he gave a second sermon. He had more to say. Now, the second sermon is called the Sermon on the Non-Existence of the Soul. That, in Buddhist literature, that's like the official title from ancient Buddhist websites. That's the official title. The Sermon on the Non-Existence of the Soul. The problem is, it's a very short sermon. It's actually just like less than half a page. The problem is, in the official Buddhist sermon on the non-existence of the soul, he never says the soul doesn't exist. That apparently didn't bother a lot of Buddhists. But it did start to bother them when a lot of Buddhists said, "Hey, wait a second, there is a soul." So, what they said is that Buddha speaks at two different levels. Amazingly enough, you know, just as there's this problem of finding the historical Jesus, like, what did Jesus really teach? In that joke where Jesus goes back to heaven, he comes into the presence of the Father, who welcomes him and says, "My son, please come." And he says, I just ask you one more time, my son, exactly what did you tell those people? So, Jesus is great. Jesus is a very admirable figure. But if you study the history of the Jesus movement as it morphed into a church, it's amazing how far it drifted from the historical Jesus. It really traveled. And if you look at the history and look at what actually happened, so that you end up with this significant gap, this huge gap between, as far as we can understand, the historical Jesus, who is a very, like I said, a very impressive figure, I think, for any open-minded person. So you have the historical Jesus, and then you have all these interpretations and new doctrines upon new doctrines upon new doctrines, and they start to really separate a certain point. And that's why you get the really bad set of facts, like the history. You have this extremely violent and problematic history in the service of the Prince of Peace. So, not in a sense of violence, but in terms of really drifting very, very far away from an original historical fact, you get this tremendous drift in historical Buddhism. It's amazing. So much so, that when you have this sort of Mahayana revolution, which became, like, now they're like 85 to 90% of all the Buddhists in the world. So it really is most of Buddhism. And it started actually around the time of Jesus when it started. And what's amazing is that the Mahayana school themselves, they taught, in fact still do to some extent, they taught that the historical Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, the historical Buddha and his first followers, the followers that really traveled around with him and camped down with him and, you know, talked to him, personally autographed glossy pictures. I mean, the personal followers of the Buddha were basically kind of fools. And what Buddha taught them was really just what you teach a fool or a childish person to, They even gave the example that if you find your children, Buddha forbid, you know, trapped in a house that's on fire, and you can't get them to come out, they just don't understand what you're saying. You tell them, oh, there's some nice new toys outside the house. You tell them a story to get them to come out. And Plato actually also said that, sometimes you got to tell the people these stories, like myths, just to teach them. And the U.S. government seems to be following a Platonic Buddhist tradition, which shows the depth of their learning. So this was really the Mahayana position. They really saw, like the early people that actually lived with Buddha, were actually like childish and foolish. And therefore Buddha taught them all these things which aren't the real facts, or they aren't the important facts, which now Mahayana is teaching. One of the three or four most prominent disciples, personal disciples of Buddha, was a gentleman named Sariputra. And Sariputra, in the early Buddhist community, when Buddha was actually there, was known sort of as the philosopher of the group. He was real smart, and because Buddha was like sort of saying this and saying that, he was one who was supposed to be sort of coming up with the Abhidharma, which means the Dharma is the Buddha's teachings, and Abhidharma means about the Dharma, about the Buddha's teachings, and it was sort of like their Talmud or something, where they... And so he was like systematizing the Buddha's teachings, and he was like the real brain in the original Buddhist community. And in the Mahayana literature, he becomes a clown. He becomes a buffoon. He's like the butt of the jokes. Because he's the one who thought he understood. So you have, it's amazing, the Mahayana explicitly rejects or just puts down as preliminary, childish, just for the moment, not the real truth, the historical Buddhist teachings, what he actually taught the people that he camped out with as he traveled around teaching. And therefore, only anyone that's not a fool will not take that stuff too seriously, but rather take seriously what Mahayana's teaching. So, anyway, we go on and on and on. I mean, very soon after the historical Buddha passed away, not too long after that, there were no less than 18 schools of Buddhism. And there's so many things to say about that. So therefore, they have to have these two levels of truth because, well, with the Buddha, so you could basically, they have these two truths, what they call the two truth doctrine. So basically, you could read in the Buddhist scriptures what Buddha actually taught, and if you didn't like something, and you could just say, well, that was, he just taught that for the childish, ignorant people. That's not what he really meant. And something that you taught, you could say, well, that's what Buddha really meant. In fact, Buddha really inspired me to say that. You find the same thing, by the way, in chapter 14 of the book of John, where a book written in West Turkey, several generations after Jesus, where retroactively the church is justifying all their large volume of new doctrines, which everyone knew Jesus didn't teach. And so they have the Greek-speaking Jesus, the Jesus who makes plays on words in Greek, a language you didn't speak, in the book of John. You have Jesus saying that, well, you know, the Holy Spirit's going to come in my name and teach you things that you didn't hear from me, but don't worry, don't get nervous, because it's me speaking through the Holy Spirit, like it's still me. And so the church actually had to establish the Holy Spirit as a third entity. It was like the Father and the Son. They had to establish the Holy Spirit as a third entity, which is not really the way the Old Testament teaches it, because they needed some authority for all the new doctrine they were inventing. Because in the early Jesus community, I mean for Jesus himself, the Old Testament was authoritative, although you had to understand it properly. For example, Jesus, I think one of his most brilliant moves, he said that, look, there's all these laws and everything. You can't humanly follow all these laws. So just follow two principles and then, you know, you're a winner. And that is, love God with all your heart, soul, and might. Love your neighbor as yourself. Do those two things, and you know, you win the lottery. So Jesus himself quoted the Old Testament, and the church began manufacturing all kinds of really, like, beautiful doctrines, like eternal hell and original sin.
No soul in women.
Did you say?
Saint Augustine.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, I guess he was trying to come. Anyway, Augustine's a whole story. So anyway, because he had all these new doctrines, everyone knew it was not the Old Testament, and people even knew that, I don't think Jesus taught this. And so they had to justify it. So it was not in the Old Testament, and Jesus didn't personally teach it. It's like, why do we believe this? Could you explain again why we believe this? So the church, so therefore they produced a book, which teaches, Book of John, which teaches where Jesus, the Greek-speaking Jesus, says that all these new doctrines are okay because it's just the Holy Spirit. It's me speaking to the Holy Spirit. In other words, they needed a third entity to justify new doctrines. So they came up with one. And then, if you look at these historical religions like Buddhism and Jesus, there are, even Islam, I mean, there are significant issues. There are significant issues about historical drift. And so, just as the Buddhists came up with this two-truth doctrine, because Buddha just kept saying things that, well, just didn't sound like there's no soul. So they have to explain it. So similarly, Shankar comes up with this two-truth thing. Because if you look at the Vedas, you look at the Upanishads, there's just like hundreds and hundreds of statements about souls, individual souls. And so basically anything that doesn't fit Shankar's philosophy, he just dumps in the lower truth basket. And he ends up actually dumping most of the Vedas.
Okay.
So... And he basically, just like a few little sentences he picks out are keepers, and everything else gets dumped in the lower truth basket. So he sort of dumps most of the tradition. In the defense of a philosophy, which first of all goes diametrically against all of our personal experience of being alive, which is all of us experience that we're actually individual, conscious persons. That's what we all experience. And it goes against all logic, because the world really exists until you realize it doesn't. Okay. So, we'll read a little bit more of this, and... Shankar goes to some lengths to establish that the appearance of plurality, that then there's many things, because ultimately he's going to say, when you're enlightened, there's only one thing, it's just Brahman. But the appearance of plurality does have conventional reality, even if it is not ultimately real. He introduces two levels of reality, conventional and absolute, in the process exposing himself to accusations of being a, quote, crypto-Buddhist, Channabodha, to the Puranas. Shankar emphatically, because the Buddha said that when you enter nirvana, you realize this world is just empty. You've heard of that, like the Shunyavad in Buddhism. So there was a gentleman living in South India around 150 CE named Nagarjuna, Snake Arjuna, or Elephant Arjuna. And he taught... He's the most famous teacher of shunyata, voidism, or emptiness. And the idea, he also said that the world, I mean, you know, he didn't bump into walls or fall off cliffs because he knew there's a world there. And so there's obviously a real world out here. And if someone, you know, if he knocked his head on the wall of his monastery, you know, he's hurt. So he obviously knew that there's a real world, but he said that if you take any material thing, or just anything in the world, like say a book, the reason I'm mentioning this is because the Buddhists do not actually teach that the world doesn't exist. I mean, voidism, the voids don't actually teach that, and I know for most of my adult life, I thought that's what they teach. But actually, they don't. So, Nagarjuna, who was the most famous philosopher of voidism, or emptiness, as it's often translated, wrote a book called the Madhyama Karika, or Madhyamika Karika, the treatise on the middle way. And he called it the middle way because he explicitly rejects the idea of voidism. He says, some people say there's an eternal soul, some people say that the world doesn't exist at all, I'm choosing the middle way. So the most famous Buddhist philosopher of Shunyavad, voidism or emptiness, that was one of his main points, that there isn't a void. There's not actually a void. In other words, he knew that that there's a real world here. But what he meant is that, this gets a little tricky, but I'll try to explain it. Well, it's based on what they believe Buddha taught, the doctrine of Pratitya Samuppada, which is often translated, usually translated, dependent origination. So, what that means is, if you, again, the book, just take this book. Well, don't take it, because I need to look at it. The gods of Eva. That, Nous parlons français, il y a beaucoup de temps. So, the emptiness, I used to always, I'm a Christian from Poland, and my Polish was non-existent. And so, and she didn't speak English so well in the past, we just speak in French, she's writing letters in French. She was a French student. So, the emptiness means, if you take this book, he'd say, well, where's the book? Because, for example, there are a bunch of pages, and the pages you could tear into little pieces, and there's letters. And so if you take all the parts away, all it is just parts. There's no thing which is the book. There's just all these different parts. Okay. There's all these different parts, and because the book didn't arise by itself, it didn't just like burst into reality, flexing its ontological muscles. It actually, someone made it. And so to Nagarjuna and his friends, and perhaps only to them, it seemed very clear that anything which does not exist independently doesn't really exist. That if I say this is a book, what I mean is the book exists independently, like nobody made it, and it's not depending on any other laws of nature. But I don't think I ever in my life meant that when I said, here's a book. But somehow Nagarjuna believes that when you say something exists, what you mean is it exists independently. Since everything depends on everything else, it's sort of like the universe is just this interdependent process. There are no real things. So in that sense, anything, like a person or a book or a table, is empty. It's empty because it's not really that thing. It's just a bunch of parts, which are themselves parts, and it's all flowing and changing. And there's no real stable thing in the world. And so, still, all these sort of unstable, changing, flowing parts. Well, they're stable.
I'm sorry, does that only refer to the physical world? Or?
No, there's no soul either. Because if you look at yourself, in fact, this goes back to the second lecture in the Deer Park, the lecture on the non-existence of the soul, where Buddha doesn't say the soul doesn't exist. But what Buddha does say there is that in your present condition, just the way you exist right now, and your present state of consciousness, you can look at the different components of it. For example, there's your physical body. There is your feelings. There are your feelings. Your physical body, your feelings, your emotions, just the way you organize the world, like, you know, this is home, that's the neighbor, just the way you sort of organize things, categorize the world. And your deep psychological conditioning. And sort of like you put it all together, like your consciousness, that none of these things are the soul. Because they're all based on and conditioned by material world. So therefore, none of these things, none of these things are the soul. And Buddha kind of left it at that. And then the Buddha said, well, what Buddha must mean is that, because that's all there's no soul. He didn't exactly say that. He just said, you know, there's all these components, none of these is the soul. And so, so therefore, Nagarjuna was really enthusiastic about the idea of there not being a soul. I mean, I don't know what happened and what kind of childhood experiences he had, but somehow he's very enthusiastic about not being an eternal person. Maybe he didn't. I don't know. To me, it's a very strange psychology. So, now, but Nagarjuna realized that even though this world is unstable and flowing and all that, things are stable enough so you can bump into them or burn yourself on them and on fire. You can say it's just not really a thing in itself, but I don't know. But you can still burn yourself on the... You could say that every individual fire is just empty. It's empty. You're talking about Buddhism. And Nagarjuna's amazing attempt to end philosophy. Actually, that was his goal. I mean, a lot of his students thought what he's trying to do is not put forward a doctrine of his own, but just show the impossibility of establishing any doctrine. The problem with that is that if you say everything is empty and there's no real things, that is a doctrine. Mm-hmm. But contradictions don't seem to even slow down some of these people. Anyway, so things are, I mean, Nagarjuna recognized that even in this unstable, ever-changing, nothing really exists as a thing in itself world, things are stable enough, long enough, so you can really, you know, like if that's a fire, don't walk into it, even though the fire is empty. Because it's going to be a fire long enough to really mess you up. So, I mean, Nagarjuna realized that. He realized that. But ultimately, the world, if we could see the world as it really is. And he also, another important thing that he taught is that, which is actually something we teach in a different way, that there's no real difference between nirvana and samsara. Samsara being this world where we're wandering from birth to birth, life to life. There's really no difference between nirvana and samsara. If you're in the right consciousness, it's not that you have to go somewhere else, not that you have to travel like 20 light years past the Milky Way or something. The idea is that if you're in the right state of consciousness, even in this world, even in Alachua County in the summer, this is a very extreme example, even in this world, that's nirvana. It's a state of consciousness. It's not a geographical place. And of course, there is a verse in the Bhagavatam saying that Narayana Parakshave, those who are dedicated to Narayan, Swargapa Vargana Dakeshu. Whether they're in material heaven, or liberated, or in hell, it's all the same to them. Because, so this idea that if you're in the right consciousness, don't sweat the geography. That's something which Nagarjuna taught, and it's also something we teach. So, but that's his voidism. Because things are temporary, they're void of real meaning. See, in a sense, the Buddhist voidism, or the Buddhist emptiness, shunyata, it's really the same thing we teach, but it gets aborted prematurely. In other words, we also say that Krishna says, for example, in chapter 2 of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, nasato vidyate bhavo, for the asat, that which is temporary, there's no bhava, there's no real existence. And for the sat, that which really exists, there's no non-existence. So Krishna uses this language himself. And so Nagarjuna is simply saying that things which are temporary are not really things in themselves. Things which depend on other things that are temporary don't exist independently. There's two big problems with Nagarjuna. In other words, the first thing is the English word exist, or the Sanskrit word asti. That's not what it means. It doesn't mean exist independently. I mean, look it up in the dictionary. That's not what it means in the Sanskrit dictionary. That's not what it means in the English dictionary. It's just not what the word means. So he's giving this very special meaning of a word and then saying that nothing exists. And they have this cute little thing which, you know, you just want to... Anyway. They have this cute little thing that they call the Chatur Chatushkoti or something. This little four-point thing that about anything in the world, you cannot say it exists. You cannot say it doesn't exist. You cannot say it exists and doesn't exist. And you cannot say it neither exists nor exists. And then another very important thing to understand, if you want to understand Buddhism, is that there's very strong evidence that Buddha was not actually teaching an ontology. He was not actually teaching about how the world out there really is. He was just giving meditation techniques. Mm-hmm. It was actually psychological, not ontological. And there were these Buddhist koans that kind of like shut down your mind computer crashes. They give those like in Zen as meditation techniques just to get you to stop thinking and just experience without thinking, because like, you know, you're thinking too much. And so ultimately, it's not a description. It's not an objective description of the way the universe is. It's just a meditation technique. And the problem with Nagarjuna, I think, among other things, or people, his followers, is they are mistaking a psychology for an ontology. It's just like we use the English word selfless, like be selfless. We don't mean have no self. Or we say, for example, don't think about yourself, just forget yourself. In other words, you're supposed to go help this person, but you're so selfish you didn't go to help the person. Forget yourself and go help this person. I mean, if you literally forgot yourself, well, life would get very difficult. So, but it's a way of speaking. So Buddha was saying, just, you know, forget yourself. Don't think about yourself. Just meditate. Just be conscious. And so the idea was that thinking, in terms of concepts and arguments and all that, ultimately is an obstacle just to pure cognition. And therefore, they were like, present these paradoxes, sort of shut your computer down. So you just go into this cognition mode. Problem is that frankly, I mean, it's nice sometimes just to go with the flow and just cognize without thinking, but I think it gets very boring. And I actually like being active, and words can be very beautiful. I mean, sometimes if under certain circumstances someone just says, I love you, it can totally transform your life if they say it and they mean it. I mean, words can be very powerful, and words can be very beautiful. And I mean, I feel like saying stop the word bashing, because words are really great if you use them properly. Even the Buddhas wrote thousands of books explaining why, you know, words aren't important. So Nagarjuna stops too soon because he says, okay, I mean, we could accept that. Based on Krishna's statement of the Gita, nasato vidyate bhavo, na bhavo vidyate, we could say, yeah, you're right. In a sense, this really is just a world of names and forms. It's in the Bhagavatam, nama rupa. And that's what the Buddhas were saying. That, for example, we call this a house. Well, you call it that. You don't have to live in it. But anyway, if you call this a house, but actually, you can say it's just a form. It's just nature has formed itself in a certain way, and we put a name on it. And really, it's just property. It's just energy. So we also use that kind of language sometimes. Mm-hmm. However, Nagarjuna goes too far and says, and therefore there is no substance. There is no substance, spiritual or material. There's just, first of all, which goes against science, because science would say there is such a thing as energy. So Nagarjuna was kind of like pre-physics. And the other problem is, there are really spiritual substances. There are permanent souls, and there's God. And so for Nagarjuna to be a universal skeptic, universal skepticism, where he denies any permanent, unchanging object. Although, the whole reason he's teaching all this is so you can be in Buddha or Nirvana consciousness, And that doesn't change once you get there. So there is a substance, namely Buddha consciousness. Oh, he says there's none. So it's like there's so many contradictions and so many incoherence, so much incoherence that it makes you want to go and join the Hare Krishna movement. Really. Because once you really start to nail this stuff down and look at it closely, it's just full of incoherence, and it's unimaginative. It's unimaginative. Interestingly, in the Mahayana Buddhism, which is now over 85% of all Buddhists, their goal is to go to heaven. They actually want to go to heaven. They have guardian angels and saints, and they want to go to heaven. That's one part. It's one part of it. Pure land. Yeah, that's the pure land. You go to heaven. And there's heaven, above heavens. And you can reunite with your ancestors and have, you know, a big Buddhist family reunion. You know, of course, the Buddhists, you do have to contact your local Mormon church by getting a complete genealogical printout. Make sure that all your ancestors are there. They touch you to heaven. But
Atreya,
yes.
What kind of relevance had that consciousness in the political or development, you know, material developing at the time? I mean, no purpose. I mean, you're part of a mask.
Well, Ashoka, actually there was this Indian emperor, Ashoka, around 2300 years ago, who when he was young was really into gobbling up neighboring kingdoms. He was a real empire builder, and he wanted to conquer Kalinga, which is mostly what's now called Orissa in eastern India. And so they had a battle there, and he won, but it was just this horrific victory, like something like 100,000 people were killed. And the emperor himself, Ashoka, was just like, I guess almost like traumatized. He was just like really shocked. And at that time, Buddhism was going around. He was from Magadha, now Bihar. And so Buddhism and Jainism, which was actually just as strong as Buddhism for many, many centuries in India, they were from the same place. It was a local thing. And they were, and the Buddhists and Jains were stressing ahimsa, nonviolence. And so after this horrible experience of winning the war, but just at this cost, which he thought was just, I mean, he was really shocked by all the violence. And so he began to patronize Buddhism. That's how Buddhism spread, among other things. You know, in fairness to Buddha, as an avatar of Vishnu, Vedic culture at that time really was out of control. And that's actually what, you know, our tradition teaches. Animal killing, they had basically this huge Vedic kosher industry, where they were sort of, you know, koshering meat by Vedic sacrifices. And it was really out of control. It was violent and materialistic in many ways. Although there were other spiritual things going on. And so Buddha really had a very powerful positive effect on India. For one thing, Buddhism and Jainism actually both really kind of like shamed the rest of the country into vegetarianism. And it's very much to the credit of those people back then, of India back then, that it could be shamed an animal into respecting other life forms. Many people in our country are kind of like, you know, impervious to the... Of course, if you kill a dog, you can go to jail. But if you kill a cow, it's... well, that's cool. The idea is that if you think about the worst kind of government, which is sort of the decadent tyrant. The tyrant puts his thumb up, you live, thumb down, you die. In other words, you have no intrinsic rights. You have no rights within yourself. The rights are simply the whim of the tyrant. And in more civilized forms of government, it's recognized that the rights, your rights, actually reside within you. So the leader is not giving you the rights. The leader is simply acknowledging what you already possess. Mm-hmm. So how can we say that dogs have rights because they're cute pets? And obviously most people nowadays live in cities, you can't really keep a cow as a pet in an apartment. And so, if you take two mammals, that's actually four, if you take two mammals who are basically, I mean, have the same level of cognitive development, their rights somehow have something to do with their consciousness. It can't just be the whim of a tyrant. And after all, why have human rights? I mean, actually, the idea that we have human rights because we're human beings is philosophically comical. And the philosopher who showed the silliness of this was David Hume, sort of a very pleasant, sociable atheist, ever in the late 1700s. And Hume said, basically, that's a very good point, that you cannot derive a metaphysical fact from a physical fact. In other words, let's say someone breaks into someone else's house and steals their gold-studded frisbee or something. Let's say like someone goes into your house and steals something. And you say that's a crime, that's bad, that's immoral. Now, what Hume would say is, the fact that someone broke into your house and took something is just a physical fact. It's just a fact in the world. To say that it's unfair or immoral is a metaphysical claim. What is there about the physical act? Where is the immorality? If someone causes physical harm to another person, where is the immorality? What is it? It's not a physical thing you can point to. So what is it? In other words, justice is not a physical object, it's a metaphysical value. It's a metaphys. Meta in Greek means beyond. So it's metaphysical, it's beyond the physical. And so if you accept there is a real thing in the world called justice, a real thing, it's not just human imagination, there's real justice. So that if someone, let's say, harms an innocent person, and you say that's bad, you're not merely saying that I'm programmed by evolution to feel unpleasant emotions when that happens. No, you mean it's bad. You really mean it's bad. And so if you think that there is such a thing as justice and injustice, then that means you believe there are real things that exist in the universe that are not physical. So if there are real things that exist in the universe that are not physical, what kind of universe are we in?
A non-physical
world. Well, there is a physical world also. So, you can only derive a metaphysical fact from another metaphysical fact. And actually, Thomas Jefferson, who was bright, he knew this. Therefore, in the Declaration of Independence, he said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that we are created equal, endowed by the Creator with rights." So Jefferson logically derived metaphysical facts from another metaphysical fact. In other words, the metaphysical fact which everyone would agree with, and therefore that's one he used, is that there's a Creator. Mm-hmm. There's a Creator who's not a material being. And the Creator is the source of our rights. So he derived a metaphysical fact from an even more powerful metaphysical fact. Whereas if you say that because I am physiologically, anatomically human, therefore I have rights, it's like, can you explain that? It's just like, I mean, study the human anatomy, where's the right? Is it like in your elbow and your kidney? Is it even in your heart or brain? Like, what is it? Like, what's a right? There's another really great one, which is equality. Equality is scientifically absurd. There's virtually unanimous empirical scientific evidence that we're not equal. And what's interesting is, we live in a the form of the political system in our country is called secular democracy. Secular means no, it's not religious. Right? Secular democracy, and yet is based on a religious assumption. If you say we're equal, that's why we all get to vote, right? Because we're equal. So if you say we're equal, my simple question is, how do you know that's true? How do you know that's true? If you, let's say, go to court against abortion, the first thing the judge will say is, don't quote the Bible. Don't quote the Bhagavad Gita. Bring in scientific evidence. And yet the whole political system is based on religious assumption. Equality is a religious assumption.
Concerning the essence of the self.
The essence of the self is not a scientific notion. In a material sense. So anyway, back to Buddhism, back to Shankara. So there's, any questions at this point? I mean, we've kind of gone all over the place. Shankara, Buddhism, the Declaration of Independence. No questions? Ollie?
Mm-hmm. Are we talking about the search for historic Buddha and the historic Jesus? But my understanding is that yes, they composed the Vedas.
Yes.
But he didn't write them down.
Right.
So what makes our scripture more authoritative than other scriptures? Because it seems
I didn't speak about authoritative. I just said there's no historical Krishna. The extent that we know about Krishna through the Bhagavatam or other books, there is no difference between what Krishna teaches in the Gita and what is said about Krishna. Now clearly Krishna's appearance in this world is beyond the horizon of worldly historiography. It's just beyond the horizon. Perhaps a better analogy would be Lord Chaitanya. Mm-hmm. So there are certain sources of information. I mean, we don't teach that what Krishna taught in the Bhagavad Gita was actually just, you know, it's not really the truth. It just taught it to a bunch of losers. I mean, we don't say that. We also don't invent a lot of new doctrine. Basically, what we teach can be traced to the Bhagavatam and the Gita. So we're talking about a gap. I mean, for that matter, we have no historical evidence that, you know, for anything Buddha taught. But we accept, basically, yeah, there's certain old writings of probably roughly what he said.
Because Yasadeva
does say that it was composed for the less intelligent. Yes, that's true. He does say that, but if you look at the Mahabharata doesn't deny anything in the Gita. It doesn't deny the Bhagavatam. It just focuses on other things. And we don't say those things. I mean, like, if you look at what Vyasadeva presented, different processes, we accept as valid under certain circumstances. Krishna accepts as valid. But you have to work your way up gradually. Krishna says in chapter 12 of the Gita, you know, just surrender to me. If you can't do that, practice bhakti yoga. If you can't do that, I don't know, you know, feed hungry people and make an opiate or something. So the idea is that Krishna himself, in the Bhagavad Gita, recognizes different stages of development. And we accept, and as far as Krishna himself, what Krishna himself teaches in the Gita, and what's said about Krishna in the Bhagavatam, and what Lord Chaitanya taught, I think there is real consistency and coherence. Talking about coherence.
Okay. I can see if I can say in English.
Okay.
Being the Buddha is an incarnation of Lord Vishnu. And Vishnu have many personalities. Could Buddha just be one of the personality of...
My understanding is that he's like a jiva soul. I don't think it was... Buddha did a lot of good. He actually did, and together with the Jains also, did a tremendous amount to stop brutality in India. And also they refocused the whole discourse, religious discourse, they refocused it on being a good person. Whereas before, people were kind of, you know, I meditate like this, and I have this mystic vision of that, and atma, or rituals. But Buddhism really focused the talk on what about being a good person, but what about how you treat other people. And that became much more important in India, in general, in many different traditions. So Buddhism had some very positive ideas, and also they, I mean, the Vedic culture in India had become, as I put it, to some extent, an unresponsive monopoly. It's like you're the only one in town, so you don't get good service. And the Vedic culture did have to really, like, get back in shape and become much more responsive. And if you study the Upanishads that are written before and after Buddha, you see the ones written after Buddha are actually, they're much more straightforward. It's not just very esoteric, hard to understand, symbolic stuff. I mean, some is straightforward. There's a lot which is really just, it's like a private club for Brahmins and you're not invited. And then after Buddha, you see the ancient Upanishads, which become much more explicit, much more just sort of straight talk, like this is the way it is. And also providing opportunities for other people. And also the whole bhakti movement, I mean, it really flowered because, so the, basically, as I've been teaching in the past, basically the Vedic culture did respond to the challenge of Buddhism and Jainism and responded successfully and ultimately won. But the challenge, I think, was a very healthy one in many ways. And in many ways, it actually improved India. And you wouldn't expect less from an avatar, right? So, no other questions? Yes?
We make this distinction between Brahmavadis and Mayavadis. I don't know where that comes from. The way
Brahmavadi just says that, you know, I'm interested in Brahman.
So Mayavadi. Don't deny.
By the way, Shankara technically wasn't a Mayavadi for a few reasons. For one thing, because he didn't use the term Maya. He used the term Avidya. And so he didn't refer to Krishna as body. So he just didn't technically use the term Maya. His followers did. His followers were actually much heavier than he was. Even in his book on Indian philosophy, it says at the end, I'll read you something actually about Shankara, who we accept as Lord Shiva, that... let's see if I can find it here. Oh, here it is. It is often overlooked that Shankara was a theistic monist. He wrote this beautiful prayer to Krishna, you know, glorifying the Bhagavad Gita. He was actually a theistic monist. He was a devotee of a personal lord, Krishna. Well, also holding that ultimately all was one. The positing of the existence of a personal Lord is no more problematic for a monist than are the pluralities around us. Ultimately, it is all Brahman. Personal Lord, no less than people and objects. Actually, that was a foolish statement in this book, by the way, because it is a problem. I mean, if you really love someone, but that person is going to dissolve, I really love you, of course, you aren't really you. That's very encouraging in a relationship. So... you know, ultimately, it's not really you, and you just aren't really the person I love. You know, that always makes for a great relationship. So, to say that I can be devoted to a personal Lord, even though I'm teaching, as he teaches earlier, there's some really heavy statements, maybe it's in the other book I'm using, that ultimately the Saguna Brahma, the idea of an Ishwar, of a Lord, is just an illusion. That when you become fully enlightened, that's another illusion. So what kind of love is that we love someone, but you say, I love you, but actually you're an illusion. And so when I really, you know, sort of sober up, you won't even be there. That's not my idea of devotion. Oh, it's very popular nowadays in marriage. Yes?
Maybe it's because we are not Krishna conscious yet. All Krishna consciousness means yet. All fully Krishna consciousness.
But it's different to say that I love you now, and the more I become enlightened, the more I'll love you. that the reason I don't love you as much as I should is because I'm still kind of a bit of a jerk. However, I'm working on it, eating lots of fried cholesterolic prasadam. And as I gradually become purified before my premature death due to Mahaprasadam, as I gradually become purified, then I will even love you more. So if you say you love someone, but of course once I really kind of wake up, you won't even exist in my life. That's very different than saying I love you, and when I wake up, I'll even love you more. They're very, very different. So to say, for someone that believes in a personal God, it's not problematic to think, as Shankara did, it's kind of, what are you talking about? It sounds like the person that wrote this doesn't really know what bhakti is. Yes?
So, what's popular is called Vipassana. The Vipassana is the Buddhist meditation. And it's like the teachings of Goenkaji, and they say that they've uncovered the historical Buddha. And they follow...
It's amazing. The real Buddha's been uncovered hundreds of times before, but this is probably the real one.
Well, they follow him so strictly. They follow the four regs. They're strict vegetarians. And their whole meditation process is basically they run these 10-day silent retreats where all you do is Vedana.
The Buddha basically never stopped talking.
Well, the teacher speaks it. The teacher speaks. The students don't speak, but the teachers speak.
So what does the teacher say?
Well, they talk about, I don't know, I've never done these retreats, but the whole focus is focusing on Vedana, these bodily sensations. So you just focus
Vedana.
On...
Vedana.
Vedana. So...
Which Buddha said is not really you.
Yeah, and that's the whole... I mean, to me, it's just the same thing as, like, mantra sparshas to contemplate.
So, in other words, focusing on bodily sensations, so you realize it's not really me.
Yeah, you realize that unpleasant or pleasant bodily sensations are your cause of distress. So.
Which I don't agree with. Shitoshin duk sukha duka da. No, not really. For example, when I was on the West Coast, there was really nice weather, and I'm not really aware of how it distressed me. So, as what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita is that matra, sparshast, literally the like sense object touch, contact with sense objects, Shitoshna, such as cold and heat. Sukha dukkha, give happiness and distress. Agma panya nitya, they come and go, they're temporary. Balance the teachers, so by the one should tolerate them. So, it's the attachment, according to that's what Buddha taught. Buddha taught the attachment causes the distress, not the sensations. It's the attachment to them. So if I'm attached to something, then that will ultimately become frustrated because everything's temporary. Whatever I'm attached to is temporary. And do they do anything else or just that?
I don't know. I don't know.
I mean, that's nice, but it's nice as far as it goes, but it doesn't go that far.
Well, I've known several people that have come to Krishna consciousness having practiced this meditation.
Yeah.
And they say that it put them on a platform where they were open. So it was like they were liberated, and then they were open to find.
Liberated.
I've gone through
I don't know if I'd use the word liberated. I mean, it's true that basically, yeah, there are many devotees. You'll find devotees who in many, many different ways were trying to reach a higher state of consciousness, trying to get wisdom, And people went through many different things. And you can find a few, and so you can find, and so what all these things have in common is, you could say they were heading toward the mode of goodness. And there's a sense in which, if you read the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 18, verses 20-22, Krishna talks about jnana, the three modes of nature, that the mode of nature, the mode of passion, you take the diversity to be fundamental, so everything's just different. And as you come to the mode of goodness, you see one unperishing state of existence behind all the variety. So as people come to the mode of goodness, they come together. Because there is a, what the, in the Western tradition, they call the philosophia perenni, the perennial philosophy. In other words, there's a common understanding, a common wisdom. So as people approach this common wisdom, whether they do it through vipassana or through many, many other methods, they're headed toward Krishna. Of course, the vast majority of people who do vipassana do not, in fact, become devotees. And therefore, you can't really say that this is the cause of becoming devotee. Rather, they were trying to elevate themselves, and that technique, could be a valid technique for becoming, strengthening your sattva guna. And that by doing that, because Krishna says, tasmat sattva nirmalatva prakashakam anami. It is actually sattva guna which is enlightening, prakashakam, and anamayam, relatively pure. So all these different techniques, what they have in common is that they are helping one become stronger in sattva guna. And it's actually the sattva guna itself which gives us wisdom. It's that quality of goodness itself that gives us wisdom.
Prabhupada talks about the word descontaminar la mente, to
uncontaminate the mind.
So that could be.
It's true that we are not the Vedana. That's true, and listening to that and focusing on that and realizing not this body is certainly a valid thing. Other people practice yoga, other people, what all these things have in common is that there's hundreds of different ways by which people sort of try to get to the mode of goodness, or try to get to this common state of understanding.
Some people just naturally are inclined
to
the moral principles.
Because even if you don't practice any technique, if you're just a good person, you'll get the same wisdom.
You get the same
word? Wisdom. Generic, basically.
The wisdom is that
you're not your body?
We're all interconnected.
Well, we're all, there's a unity among everyone, because I know myself, I was at a party at Venice Beach in 1967. And I suddenly realized that, we're not these bodies. I just a party at Venice Beach, and as a kid I was like 18 years old or something, and 19 or something, and I just suddenly realized not our bodies. And so, devotees have all kinds of experiences and everything. So, somehow or other, people come in different ways, but Krishna says sattva guna is prakashakam, it's enlightenment. And there's like hundreds of different techniques nowadays. I mean, in LA, they have a phone book this thick, just of New Age things.
Actually, but also the chanting of the Hare Krishna is not like an automatic ticket.
Well, it depends on the quality of the chanting. I mean, it's always beneficial. But if you want to, obviously, Krishna says, I reciprocate. So chanting is always good. But it's much more powerful if you take it more seriously.
And I guess it's karma, too, because you see some people take over, they just take up in Krishna.
Well, it's not karma, according to the Bhagavad Gita, it's previous spiritual practice.
Well, yeah, from previously.
I I think there's some climate involved too in what you can or can't do. Because I noticed, like, for myself, being in the female body, and then so many years in ISKCON, it was bad karma sometimes to be in the female body, because I couldn't go, you know, hang out with the sannyasis or whatever.
Sometimes it's good karma. Yeah. I mean, it depends on what mood you're in.
I think sometimes our karma allows or disallows for opportunity.
It may be, but my experience is that, you know, so having been in a virtually my entire life a male body, and also, you know, having various positions in ISKCON or anything like that, I think ultimately Krishna reciprocates with everyone, and what it's really about is Krishna consciousness. And exactly, precisely, as much as we are sincere, that much Krishna blesses you and gives you ecstatic Krishna consciousness. And as far as externally, like, I couldn't hang out with the sannyasis. They wouldn't let me in the, you know, the sannyasi volleyball game or something. I think everyone really gets exactly what they deserve. Everyone gets exactly what they deserve. And if you're sincere, nothing's holding you back. The only thing holding any of us back is our own lack of devotion. And as much as we're devoted, we get rewarded. I had an experience like that one time. I was with Prabhupada. I went to see Prabhupada in Brooklyn in 1972. And I went in to see him in the morning, just as he was finishing his breakfast. He was in sort of a very jovial mood, joking with me. He said, "Oh, Vidyananda Maharaj, you're traveling and preaching. I just sit and eat." And so he was just joking, obviously. And then he asked me about the preaching. And so he was really pleased because I was going to the colleges. And so I felt like, oh, Prabhupada's so pleased with my service. So I thought, that afternoon I went back to his room. I thought, I'll get some more recognition here. So I went back to Prabhupada's room in the afternoon. And there was some young girl, Brahmacharini, who was dusting the room or changing the flowers or something. And, in the ISKCON pecking order or the ISKCON totem pole, she was like, she wasn't low. She was a nice girl, but she was just some young girl. And so, she had no position whatsoever. So I sat there, and I noticed that Prabhupada ignored me and was paying all of his attention to her. And I realized that at that moment, she was more Krishna conscious. I was the macho sannyasi. But actually, I was kind of in this mood, like, here I am, Prabhupada, aren't you happy to see me again? and she was just with complete focus and devotion. She was cleaning his room. Prabhupada, like a very, very loving, almost a loving grandfather, he was just saying, like, oh, what's your name? And he was just like very, very affectionately just talking to her, encouraging her, and ignoring me, which, of course, I deserve to be ignored at that point. But not now. So at that moment, the mercy, as we say, getting the mercy, as we say in this business. At any moment, wherever you are, in whatever condition, whatever body you're in, if you just turn to Krishna in your heart with devotion, you will get the greatest rewards. And it really doesn't matter, how many stripes someone has on their kurta. Fly on the wall. You should have been a fly on the wall. You should have actually dressed up. No one would have known. You would have been able to dress up in this big fly thing. They would have thought it was just like an unusually large fly. Horsefly. That's what made a horsefly. No one would have realized that it was actually a Mataji.
That's we're so in the karma to be in a female body.
What? Was it?
I said even the karma to be in a female body. And then you practically don't have a choice about family life or not. And then you
involved in the family life and get distracted for so many years?
Well, most men don't seem to have a choice either. I don't see a lot of discretionary power. Yeah, we just have to, everyone has to just deal, deal with it. Once they carry their cross, carry their, you know, spoiled eggplant stuff to you or something. Everyone has to... Yeah, I mean, everyone, and ultimately, I don't think, it doesn't really matter what kind of body you have. It's just like, that's just the body. It's just a costume. Everyone, Krishna's in everyone's heart, and if you're sincere, you'll get the blessings. You'll be in higher consciousness. If not, I mean, so many women stayed in the practice, and so many men went away, and some women left, and men stayed. So, in terms of who really was successful, who stayed with Krishna, it's not really about gender, and it's not about what position you have. It's just about, it's about what you do, where no one sees it. And that's inside, you're inside in your heart. Like you can go to the temple and everyone sees you, so-and-so's at the temple. What you're really doing inside, no one knows. Just you and Krishna know that. And therefore you can see a bunch of people go to the temple and see the deity, and then some of them are missing in action, MIAs. MIA, missing in action, like soldiers, POWs, MIAs. Missing in action, prisoners of Maya. Or POW prisoners of whoops. Yeah, I have got them. So really, it's not just, I mean, the external behavior is necessary because we should practice.
Just like you're not losing out. It's just that you're getting it in a different form.
Yeah, but you're getting it. I mean, the real happiness, the real knowledge comes within your heart. And, you know, sannyasi can go, you know, go into the temple room and like, you know, like Elvis, thank you, you've been a great audience. So you can... Yeah, you can externally be this, that. So many people have these, you know, these towering external positions and then just, you know, went down in flames. And other people were just sort of insignificant, no one cared about them, but they just got stronger and stronger. So the external thing is really not what it's about. It's really about what you do, or no one sees it, but Krishna.